Hello, and welcome to another episode of A-Minder. I'm Ellen Rowe, and I'm back to fill you in on everything that happened in the field of vascular contributions to Alzheimer's disease in July 2022. This episode covers papers that showed up on PubMed in July 2022, and we've got 13 on deck today. We've got a mix of clinical and preclinical studies this month, with some proteomics to better understand the impact of amyloid deposition in cerebral vessels, some new insights into the perivascular space, and as always, lots on white matter hyperintensities. We've also got a few potential therapeutic avenues, so stay tuned to learn more about how blood vessel health is implicated in Alzheimer's disease and other dementias, and for a disease perspective a bit more lively than the classic amyloid cascade hypothesis.
Welcome to A-Minder, a podcast where we summarize the latest publications on Alzheimer's disease for you, so you can spend more time doing awesome research. For every month, you'll find a series of episodes by theme, and each comes with a bibliography. Whether you're in the lab, on the bus, or cooking your meal, we hope you find this podcast useful and accessible.
All right, welcome or welcome back. I'm really excited about the episode this month, with new research spanning really all corners of this niche field. So as always, I'll kick things off with some context for the new listeners, so go ahead and skip ahead if you're already familiar with the landscape of this research, or if you're not new here. So the brain is really one of the most highly vascularized organs in the body, with no more than a hair's width between any neuron and its closest blood vessel. As you likely know or can infer from that, the cerebrovasculature is critical in keeping the brain healthy and functional. It plays lots of key roles, like being the highway of nutrient and oxygen delivery to the brain, it's a main route of waste disposal, including amyloid clearance, and its highly selective blood-brain barrier is critical to keep blood proteins, pathogens, and immune cells out of the brain. When these functions are compromised, like when there is reduced blood flow to the brain or the blood-brain barrier is compromised, this can lead to metabolic stress and inflammatory cascades. So really, the blood vessels may actually be responsible for some of the initiating events in the Alzheimer's disease pathology. As a field, we're starting to appreciate that vascular dysfunction is an early event in the AD pathology, as we see changes in cerebral blood flow and loss of blood-brain barrier integrity with age and with the main genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, APOE4. So as we tune into the importance of the vasculature in maintaining brain health, we're learning a lot about how things might go wrong through the course of developing AD and how maintaining vascular health and function could be a new way of preventing or treating AD. So hopefully that got you hooked on the idea that we really should be paying attention to the blood vessels in the context of Alzheimer's disease. A few notes before I dive in, a reminder that A-Minder includes all papers from peer-reviewed journals for any given month, meaning that we don't exclude any based on our own perceived quality of the science or accuracy of the interpretations. We also mostly draw from the abstracts for the content of our episode, so be sure to check out the full papers for more details and really to make your own judgments on the quality of the science before you accept anything as fact. We provide free numbered bibliographies with our episodes that you can find in the show notes, so you can note down the numbers of the papers that pique your interest here and track down the full manuscripts using our bibliography. And finally, to wrap up the housekeeping items, some common abbreviations you'll hear me use in today's episode are, of course, we have AD for Alzheimer's disease, CSF for cerebral spinal fluid, BBB for blood-brain barrier, and CAA for cerebral amyloid angiopathy. Any others I'll define along the way. So with that covered, let's dive right in. We'll start things off here with a couple of papers focused on cardiovascular risk factors, starting with a paper titled Association of Carotid Intima Media Thickening with Future Brain Region-Specific Amyloid Beta Burden. This is by first author Baradarin and last author Seshadri, and this was a collaboration between several groups in the USA, published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So you've likely heard of the term atherosclerosis in the discussion of cardiovascular disease. And as a reminder, or maybe if you didn't know this, this really means narrowing of the arteries. So we know that cardiovascular risk factors are linked with the incidence of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias, but the mechanisms underpinning the relationship are still a bit fuzzy. Here, the authors focused on atherosclerosis of the carotid artery, which is the main artery feeding the brain, and how its narrowing might impact amyloid burden. The study included 47 individuals with baseline and follow-up ultrasound imaging of the carotid artery, with about 9.5 years between the two imaging time points. And importantly, the participants also had PET imaging done for amyloid about 22 years after baseline. So using multivariate linear regression, adjusting for age, sex, and other vascular risk factors, as well as medication use, they found that individuals with higher internal carotid artery thickness had higher amyloid load in the precuneus and the frontal, lateral, and retrosplenial regions. They didn't find any significant relationships between common carotid artery thickness or the thickening of the arteries over time with amyloid load. Even so, their findings with the internal carotid artery are interesting and further reinforce the link between vascular health and Alzheimer's disease. All right, next up is paper number 2, and it's titled Recurrent Transient Ischemic Attack Induces Neural Cytoskeleton Modification and Gliosis in an Experimental Model. This is by first author Wang and last author Liu from the University of North Texas Health in the USA, and it was published in Translational Stroke Research. So transient ischemic attacks occur when the blood supply to the brain is briefly blocked, and they're established risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. These authors wanted to figure out exactly how they contribute to the processes leading to dementia, and they used a rat model to do so. They modeled transient ischemic attacks by blocking the middle cerebral artery 3 times for 10 minutes each per week, and notably they didn't observe any permanent tissue death with this regimen, making it distinct from a full-blown stroke model. While they didn't see any changes to classic AD hallmarks, which are tau hyperphosphorylation or increased amyloidogenic processing, they did note several changes in neurons and glial cells. Specifically, they saw that the cytoskeleton was modified in neurons, marked by lower MAP2 and higher neurofilament light chain, and increased activation of glial cells with higher GFAP and IBA1 expression. With this, the authors concluded that transient ischemic attacks may predispose individuals to dementia via neuronal cytoskeletal changes and neuroinflammation. Definitely some interesting insight here. Looking forward to seeing more on how we can reduce transient ischemic attacks in the first place. So this next one is a bit of a stretch with its link to cardiovascular risk factors, as I have it slotted in this episode, but it didn't really fit well in any of my other subsections, so here we are. While it doesn't address any of the classic cardiovascular risk factors, it does support the notion that systemic factors can have direct impacts on the brain. This is the third paper of the episode, and it's titled Systemic Injection of Aged Blood Plasma in Adult C57BL6 Mice Induces Neurophysiological Impairments in the Hippocampal CA1. This is by first author Huffles and last author Middeldorp from the Utrecht University in the Netherlands, and it was published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. So I found this one super interesting, since part of my PhD project is characterizing blood products from aged blood donors. So a lot of work has been done to investigate the impact of plasma, especially from young or aged donors, on processes relating to aging or neurodegeneration. These kind of started with parabiosis studies, where researchers connected the circulation of young and aged mice and found that young plasma was able to rescue some of the negative age-related effects. This wound up leading to several spin-off companies and clinical trials investigating the impact of plasma from young donors on several different outcomes, including Alzheimer's disease. So definitely check out that line of research if you haven't heard of it yet. It's pretty cool. So with that long preamble, let's get into the paper now. So here the authors treated adult mice with plasma from aged mice and investigated whether factors in the blood were able to impact the hippocampal region CA1, which is affected early on in Alzheimer's disease. They found that mice treated with aged plasma had impaired long-term potentiation, changes in their glutamatergic transmission, and higher activity of voltage-gated calcium channels. Really interesting body of work demonstrating once again that factors in the bloodstream can impact neural functioning, perhaps through vascular signaling. Excited for more work in this area to unpack the specific factors in the plasma responsible for these changes. Alright, so now we're moving on to our next segment on white matter hyperintensities and other neuroimaging features. So first up, we have paper number 4 in the episode, and it's titled Disentangling the Effects of Alzheimer's and Small Vessel Disease on White Matter Fiber Tracts. This is by first author DeWinter and last author During, and this was a collaboration between groups in Germany, the Netherlands, and Switzerland, published in the journal Brain. So if you've been around for several of my episodes, you'll have heard quite a bit about white matter hyperintensities or other MRI hallmarks which are thought to reflect vascular abnormalities in the brain. You'll likely have also heard me discuss how the underlying cause of these hallmarks and their association with disease is still an active avenue of research. So here we dive deeper into that endeavor with a state-of-the-art Fixel-based analysis. Yes, Fixel, not Pixel. This is an advancement to diffusion MRI where you can analyze the white matter fibers within a voxel, or a defined space in the MRI image. So using this new fixel-based analysis, these authors were able to measure fiber density and more macroscopic changes in fiber bundle cross-sections. Specifically, their goal was to determine the distinct contributions of small vessel disease and the AD pathology to changes in these metrics, and they imaged nearly 400 individuals in the process. These include those with small vessel disease only, age match controls, and individuals across the full AD biomarker spectrum to tease apart the effects of amyloid and tau. They found that white matter fiber density was lower in those with cerebral small vessel disease and mapped well with other small vessel disease imaging hallmarks, which were lacunes, white matter hyperintensities, and microbleeds. They also found that the more macroscopic changes in fiber bundle cross-section had the strongest association with brain volume, and that both fixel-based metrics were lower when amyloid was present, but didn't seem to be worsened by tau. Interesting results, and surely we'll see more of this method applied in other cohorts. Could be a useful clinical tool. All right, sticking with our focus on better understanding how white matter hyperintensities relate to disease, here we have a paper that looked for patterns based on the diagnosed neurodegenerative disease. This one's called Differential Spatial Distribution of White Matter Lesions in Parkinson's and Alzheimer's Diseases and Cognitive Sequelae. It's paper number 5 by first author Gray and last author Rector from the Masaryk University in the Czech Republic, and this one was published in the Journal of Neural Transmission. So similar to the last paper, this one focuses on how white matter hyperintensities detected on MRI relate to other features of neurodegenerative disease. Their cross-sectional study included 40 individuals with either AD or amnesic MCI, 42 with Parkinson's disease with or without mild cognitive impairment, and 55 cognitively healthy controls. They found that those in the AD group had the highest burden of white matter hyperintensities and that subcortical white matter hyperintensities were related to worse global cognitive function. While the AD group had considerable periventricular white matter hyperintensities as well, they were only related to reduced executive function and working memory in the Parkinson's disease group. And in healthy controls, they mapped with age-related decline. While the sample size of this study was relatively small, these data suggest that white matter lesions may differentially impact cognition based on other underlying pathologies. Looking forward to more work coming down the pipeline to tease this apart further. Next up is paper number 6, titled Longitudinal Changes in Brain Oxygen Extraction Fraction, or OEF, in Older Adults, Relationship to Markers of Vascular and Alzheimer's Pathology. This is by first author Lin and last author Liu from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in the USA, and it was published in Alzheimer's and Dementia. So following last month's paper by Judhakonda et al. From Harvard that investigated the relationship between oxygen extraction efficiency, white matter hyperintensities, and capillary shunting, here we've got another interesting one extending the work and aiming to tease out similar relationships. These authors wanted to better understand how the oxygen exchange fraction, which is a ratio of oxygen consumption to delivery, related to the classic AD biomarkers, vascular risk factors, and white matter hyperintensities over time. Their study included 137 older adults with baseline measurements and another set of measurements after about 2 years. They found that the oxygen exchange fraction increased from baseline to follow-up, indicating either that there was increased oxygen consumption or decreased supply. As some context, in late-stage Alzheimer's disease, others have shown that there's a decrease in the oxygen exchange fraction as degenerated tissue consumes less oxygen. Interestingly, here the results in this paper showed that those with a higher burden of vascular risk factors had steeper increases in their oxygen exchange fractions, and the increase was also associated with increased white matter hyperintensity volume. However, change in the oxygen exchange fraction was not associated with amyloid or tau CSF markers. With this data, the authors concluded that oxygen exchange fraction in older adults without dementia primarily mapped with underlying vascular pathology. With that, we're about halfway through the episode, so we'll take a quick break here, and I'll be back with more on cerebral amyloid angiopathy, the blood-brain barrier, and some new therapeutic avenues. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Ellen Rowe, host and co-founder here at Aminder. I've been with the team since the very beginning in 2020, and I really love it because it's an outlet to hone my own science communication skills, and I feel super passionate about the mission of making sure scientists are well informed about all of the new research being churned out. It's also super rewarding to be a part of a community of like-minded and driven scientists from all career stages. If you're interested in getting involved with our team, we are currently recruiting new hosts and content creators for the show. This is a great opportunity for researchers interested in keeping up to date with the latest Alzheimer's research and getting some science communication experience in the process. If this has piqued your interest, you can reach us at aminderpodcast@gmail.com or through any of our social media platforms, and we'd love to hear a bit about you.
Nearly 1 million older Canadians live with a form of dementia. This number is expected to double within 10 years, and sadly, no solutions exist yet to dramatically reduce these numbers. It has to stop. Research can help solve this problem. We are 350 researchers fully dedicated towards preventing and finding a cure to dementia, and to improve care to those living with dementia. We are the Canadian Consortium on Neurodegeneration and Aging. The solution to dementia could be closer than you think.
All right, welcome back. Let's dive right into the next segment on cerebral amyloid angiopathy and the blood-brain barrier with our seventh paper of the episode titled SORL1 Gene Mutation and Octopeptide Repeat Insertion in PRNP Gene in a Case Presenting with Rapidly Progressive Dementia and Cerebral Amyloid Angiopathy. This is by first author Cincini and last author Celzo from the University of Milan in Italy, and it was published in the European Journal of Neurology. As you could guess from the title, here we have a case study. These can be really useful in parsing out the effects of certain genetic factors to shed light on disease mechanisms, as we saw a couple years ago with the APOE Christchurch mutation protecting against a known pathogenic PSEN1 mutation. In this paper, the authors paint the clinical picture of an 80-year-old man with dementia, neuroimaging features consistent with cerebral amyloid angiopathy, which is the deposition of amyloid in the vessel walls, and importantly, mutations in the PRNP and SORL1 genes. They noted the E270K variant in the SORL1 gene, which has been noted to increase amyloidogenic processing, and also an octopeptide repeat insertion in the prion protein gene, PRNP. Linking these mutations with the observed phenotypes in the case has the potential to spark new research avenues, so check this one out for an interesting discussion of their findings. So sticking with CAA, we have paper number 8 in our free bibliography, titled Effects of Cerebral Amyloid Angiopathy on the Brain Vasculome. This is by first author Deng and last author Baksky from the Harvard Medical School in the USA, and it was published in Aging Cell. So hoping to provide some more insight into functional vascular changes that occur alongside cerebral amyloid angiopathy, these authors isolated cerebrovascular endothelial cells from young and aged APP-PS1 mice for microarray profiling. They included age-matched wild-type controls to compare gene expression changes and found that the amyloidosis model, which presents with considerable CAA, had reduced neurotransmitter receptor and calcium signaling transductor expression in the endothelial cells, but increased expression of genes associated with inflammation and cell cycle regulation. Definitely check out the full paper for all of the specifics. There's a ton of data in this one to sift through. But overall, the authors interpreted their results as pointing to dysregulated neurovascular coupling and reactivation of the cell cycle in endothelial cells as prominent mechanisms in amyloid-dependent vascular contributions to Alzheimer's disease. Next up, we have a similar paper, but with human tissue. This is paper number 9, and it's titled Proteomics-Based Investigation of Cerebrovascular Molecular Mechanisms in Cerebral Amyloid Angiopathy by the FFPE-LMD-PCT-SWATH Method. This is by first author Handa and last author Yoshida from the Tokuhu University in Japan, and it was published in Fluids and Barriers of the CNS. So to investigate the impact of CAA on cerebral vessels, these authors laser dissected cerebral cortical vessels from formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded human tissue. They included tissue from those with AD and evident CAA, AD without CAA, and those with neither pathology, and they used pressure cycling technology to extract the proteins, then analysis with mass spectrometry. And with all of that information, I can now reveal to you that the acronym in their title stood for Formalin Fixed Paraffin Embedded Laser Microdissection Pressure Cycling Technology Sequential Window Acquisition of All Theoretical Fragment Ion Spectra. Crystal clear, I know. Okay, so on to the results. They found 17 proteins with altered expression in the CAA group compared with the AD-only group or the control group. They also identified 56 proteins that were significantly different between the AD group and the CAA group, and these appeared to be vascular-specific changes as they weren't mirrored in the parenchyma. Interestingly, the majority of their identified dysregulated proteins have roles in fibrosis, oxidative stress, and apoptosis. The fibrosis bit certainly makes sense. A thicker basement membrane with altered protein content can bind more amyloid, but more work is needed to probe into the mechanisms further. Be sure to check out the full paper here for specific proteins and some really interesting analyses. So this next one isn't directly focused on CAA, but it certainly has implications to our understanding of it. It's titled, "Periarterial Spaces Modulate Cerebrospinal Fluid Transport into the Brain and Demonstrate Altered Morphology in Aging and Alzheimer's Disease." This is paper number 10 by first author Mestre and last author Mehta, and this was a collaboration between several groups in the USA and the University of Copenhagen in Denmark, published in Nature Communications. So this is a really neat one with lots of beautiful micrographs. Definitely encourage everyone to at least scan through the figures. Here, the authors wanted to shed some light on the flow paths of perivascular spaces. You might have heard of these if you've listened to some of my episodes before. These are the sites underlying lymphatic drainage, which is when brain waste wiggles along the basement membrane of the vessels, while cerebrospinal fluid washes along the perivascular spaces to clear it. Specifically, the authors here wanted to better characterize how this drainage happens and how it may be altered with aging and disease, as many believe that late-onset Alzheimer's disease is a result of impaired waste clearance from the brain. So for this, they leveraged mouse models and did a series of beautiful immunostaining experiments to show that the pia mater, the meningeal layer closest to the brain and thought to confine flow around blood vessels, is actually perforated and made up of vascular and cerebral layers in distinct patterns. Using tracer injections, they also found that the variable structures of the pia can impact the flow of the cerebrospinal fluid along the perivascular space, and that the level of vessel coverage by the pia correlated with macrophage density and the phagocytosis of the tracer. They also found that the pia is not a barrier to CSF tracer transport, but rather it plays a role in filtration. Interestingly, they saw that the pial layer atrophied with age, but was actually thicker in the APP-PS1 model of amyloidosis. In the old wild-type mice, the authors found that the thickness of the pia correlated with better CSF flow and reduced amyloid deposits. So perhaps the result in the APP-PS1 mouse was some sort of compensatory mechanism for the genetic amyloid overload. Not quite sure. You'll have to check out the paper for a great discussion. So overall, this paper provides some fantastic insight into the dynamics of waste clearance from the brain and emphasizes the underappreciated role of the pia in this paradigm. And finally, a focus on the BBB specifically. Next up, we have paper number 11 titled "Activation of the WNT-beta-catenin Pathway Mitigates Blood-Brain Barrier Dysfunction in Alzheimer's Disease." This is by first author Wang and last author Yi, and it was a collaboration between groups in China, Australia, the USA, the UK, and Spain, published in Brain. So a lot of mechanistic research aiming to get at the underpinnings of blood-brain barrier dysfunction has focused on the WNT-beta-catenin pathway in the past decade. I've definitely come across papers on the topic several times in my episodes and in my readings. Here, the authors do a series of experiments to add to the bank of knowledge proving that this pathway is highly relevant. They start by reproducing previous data, demonstrating that the BBB is leaky in the AD brain by showing fibrinogen, which is a plasma protein, deposited in the parenchyma around vessels, and lower expression of tight and adherens junction proteins critical for keeping the blood-brain barrier tight. They then moved their work into the APP-PS1 mouse model of amyloidosis and found that suppression of the WNT-beta-catenin pathway mapped with increased GSK3-beta activation, which is a kinase responsible for tau phosphorylation as well. They also used an optogenetic tool to demonstrate that upregulating LRP6, which is an upstream regulator of the WNT pathway, led to restoration of the BBB and improved cognition in the model. So lots more data to support the mission of targeting this pathway as a viable strategy for AD treatment or prevention. And to wrap up here, we have our final segment on therapeutic avenues. So we've got our second last paper, number 12 in our free bibliography, titled "Phosphodiesterase 5 Inhibitor Microdenophil Ameliorates Alzheimer's-like Pathology and Symptoms by Multimodal Actions." This is by first author Kang and last author Chung from the Korea National Sport University. In Korea, obviously, and this was published in Alzheimer's Research and Therapy. So you may not recognize the drug mirodenafil, but I'll bet you'll recognize the brand name of another drug in the same class, Viagra. So phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors have been classically used to treat erectile dysfunction, and they do so by affecting the vasculature. As a quick biochemistry detour, phosphodiesterase 5 cleaves cyclic GMP, which leaves less of it to promote vasodilation. So by inhibiting phosphodiesterase 5, we can get increased vasodilation and improved blood flow. And that is how this paper landed in my episode. So here, the authors investigated the potential therapeutic effects of myrodenophil in the APP-C105 mouse model of cerebral amyloidosis, in the human neuroblastoma SHSY5Y cell line, and in mouse hippocampal HT22 cells. They found that treatment with myrodenophil improved cognition in the Morris water maze and the passive avoidance test, while also reducing amyloid and phosphorylated tau loads in the mouse model. In the follow-up in vitro studies, they found that the drug modulated the cGMP protein kinase C Krebs signaling pathway, the activity of GSK3-beta, and increased WNT-beta-catenin signaling by reducing the expression of its antagonist DICOF1. They further identified some unique features of myrodenophil compared with other phosphodiesterase 5 inhibitors, so check out the full paper for more details. Looks like more research will need to go into repurposing myrodenophil for AD. Looking forward to seeing some human data. So to cap things off, our final paper is titled Assessing the Role of Malonamide Linker in the Design of Potent Dual Inhibitors of Factor Xa and Cholinesterases. This is by first author Purgatorio and last author Altomare from the University of Bari Aldo Moro in Italy, and it was published in the journal Molecules. So if you haven't reviewed your coagulation cascade in a while, factor Xa is a keystone. It cleaves prothrombin into active thrombin, which can then cleave fibrinogen to produce fibrin, which is the key protein making up the clot. Inhibiting coagulation has been discussed as a potential therapeutic strategy for AD, since fibrin can sequester amyloid and worsen conditions like CAA and its downstream effects on blood flow and cognition. On another note, currently one of the only therapeutic options on the market for Alzheimer's disease are cholinesterase inhibitors, as acetylcholine neurotransmission pathways are disrupted early on in the disease, and prolonging this neurotransmitter's time in the synapse can help treat symptoms. Importantly, both factor X and acetylcholinesterase are serine proteases. So here the authors tested whether they could derive a compound that could inhibit factor Xa and cholinesterases at the same time. I'll leave the gory details of the chemistry up to you to find in the full paper, but they did identify two compounds that were potent factor Xa inhibitors and also inhibited acetylcholinesterase, making them potential candidates for improved AD therapy. Of course, there are a lot of steps between this preliminary work and the clinic, but really interesting proof of concept. And that brings us to the end of the episode. Hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed learning about all of these new, interesting lines of research. If you did, we'd love if you subscribed to us and wrote us a review on whichever platform you're using to listen to us. This helps us reach more scientists like yourself and helps us keep Alzheimer's research a well-oiled and informed machine. A reminder that we offer free bibliographies with all of our episodes so that you can track down the full papers that I've summarized here. You can find a link to all of our bibliographies in the episode notes. And we also release bibliographies for the topics that we don't currently cover with full episodes as well, like fluid biomarkers, for example. So check those out as a resource to start your literature search. Also, we're releasing episodes Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so be sure to check those out for a range of other topics related to Alzheimer's disease. Huge thank you to the whole Aminder team for bringing this project to life, and especially to our sorting team with their help in parsing out focused episodes like this one, my reviewer Cassie, Chihiro, the editor for this episode, our musician Anusha for writing the beautiful music that you hear in each episode, and our managers Sarah and Ellen Kosh, who keep Aminder going strong. Also, again, thank you to the CCNA for their sponsorship and believing in this project. If you're interested in joining this wonderful team of ours, we're always recruiting, especially now. We would love your help. So please send us an email with your CV and let us know what you're interested in helping with. We have opportunities to host episodes, to write summaries, to sort abstracts, to edit episodes, to do advertising, pretty much anything you want. So you can reach out to us through email or through Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram by searching Aminder Podcast. And of course, thank you, our listener, for tuning in. We hope you find this podcast useful and accessible. Bye for now.